Let's take a journey back to 2003. Canadian teen sensation Avril Lavigne was topping the charts and turning the music industry upside down. But what if I told you that the Avril Lavigne we know and love might not be the same Avril? What? Did Avril die? Was she replaced by a doppelganger? I'm Joanne McNally, and I'm doing a deep dive into a notorious internet conspiracy. Who replaced Avril Lavigne? Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
So now that we've had parenting influencers for more than a decade, the kids who grew up on camera are starting to speak out, and some of the stories I have to tell, I gotta tell you, are hard to hear. Today on the podcast, the heartbreaking stories of child influencers. I'm Alamin Abdul-Mahmoud. This is Commotion. Look, one striking thing to me about the internet getting older is it's old enough now that we can look back on certain trends and the industries built around them and say, what were we thinking? And one place that this is showing up is the children of mommy bloggers, of sharenters, of parenting vloggers who are now old enough to talk about what it was like to be broadcast on the internet from infancy. Fortessa Latifi has been reporting on this for a couple of years now. She's written this investigative piece for Cosmopolitan. And then after that, the magazine made a documentary about it on YouTube called The Sharenting Reckoning. The term sharenting, by the way, basically refers to just parents who overshare on social media, posting photos and videos of their children and turning them into mini-influencers. I started by asking Fortessa why she's been on this beat for 2 years now.
I think that it's because of growing up when reality TV was really hitting its zenith. And we had, like, you know, the Teen Mom kids and the Gosselin kids and the Duggar kids. And it was just, like, so strange to me to watch their entire lives unfold online and on TV. And then I started seeing that influencer kids were having this kind of mirrored experience, but their parents were the ones who were the producers and their home was the set.
Okay, so you reached out to many child influencers for this piece. One person came forward and asked you to be anonymous. I want to play you a bit of what she said to you in your interview.
And a lot of people think that creating content is super easy and that it doesn't take a lot of work, but it is a full-time job. And we'd have to sit there doing takes until like 1 or 2 a.m. for a picture or a video, trying our hardest to make sure that our smiles were perfectly right and we stuck to the script and all these different things.
That's a harrowing kind of little clip. I think, like, trying to imagine literal children, you know, being awake until the middle of the night, trying to get the correct takes of a smile so that their parents can post this, you know, picture perfect kind of childhood that doesn't really exist. What do you think about that anecdote? How do you think that anecdote tells the larger story of what child influencers go through?
I think it shows how little of a separation there is between your work and your life when you're a child influencer. So this is really different from child actors where they go on set and there are people who are, like, specifically delegated to make sure that they don't work too many hours or that they have, like, a tutor on set or, you know, they have to wrap by 5 p.m. because the kid is 12 years old. And there's none of that when it's at home, right? It's up to the parents completely and there's just no boundary.
I think the one thing that might be lost on some people is maybe the why, you know, and the why is money. These parents make hundreds of thousands of dollars, sometimes millions of dollars on this content. Where is that income coming from? Like, who is paying these parents to keep producing this content over and over?
So it depends on the platform. In the US, you get paid per view on a TikTok if you have over 10,000 followers. So they're literally just making money off of views. And these are videos with millions of views. And then the same is for YouTube. You get paid based on views. And then there's endorsement deals, there's brand deals, there's sponsored posts. So these are several different streams of income.
A major part of, I was really struck by this, but a major part of your reporting on this is how much of that money the kids themselves end up getting. What answers did you get when it comes to that variety, you know, in terms of, again, hundreds of thousands of dollars being made, how much of that does, you know, ends up with the kids?
Well, it depends if you're asking what the influencers say or what they're legally have to do, which is there's only one. Okay, so let's start with legally. Legally, there's only one state in the entire U.S. that has a law relative to influencer children and their money, and that's Illinois. And that was only passed last year. So this is brand new. So in 49 states out of the country, you're completely unprotected, which means that none of this money has to make it to the kids, right? Which is pretty astonishing. People often think that influencer kids are counted under child actor laws, but they're not. And we don't even have federal child actor laws. We only have state child actor laws. So, but I did ask the parents how they break down the money and if they give it to their kids. They did say that they have savings accounts, that they give a certain percentage to their kids. But I think the really striking thing is that no one is making sure of that, right? Like legally, they don't have to do any of that. And no one really knows. Like this is what they say, but who really knows?
I find that so surprising that there's only one state that has laws on the books to protect these kids. Even more surprising that this is only, you know, about a year old or so. Do you know of like more laws that are in the works sort of in similar vein in other states? Or is that kind of – is everybody else really behind on this?
Yeah, there are 10 different states that have introduced similar legislation that would legislate the profits of influencer kids, but none have made it past the introduction yet. So I think there is a really big movement for this to change. Just if you look at how many states are introducing the legislation, you can see that. But it remains true that there's only one state where they're currently protected.
You know, you talk in the documentary about how these share intros wrestle to balance these huge profits that they're making with the well-being of their children. Some of the folks you talk to have made the decision to stop using their children in their content outright. What are the reasons that they gave you for just completely stopping that?
I think it has to do with the cultural zeitgeist and the conversation we're having right now around privacy for kids and what kids deserve as far as like an unvarnished online footprint, as opposed to having everything from gestation onward recorded online.
From gestation onward is such a striking sentence. I continue, but just yes.
I mean, it's fascinating. Some of these kids have accounts that were made when they were in utero.
And
the ultrasounds are posted and people and like the mom or the dad will say like, you know, like talk as if they're the fetus, like in the captions, and they have like hundreds of thousands of followers before they're even born.
Fortessa, the reason that audiences are drawn to these parenting influencers is because it kind of feels, it mimics what real life feels like to them, right? So it's ironic that a couple of times in your documentary, the kids are referred to as actors, and there isn't a commitment to the truth the way that we might expect, because they're supposed to be relatable in ways that like traditional celebrities are not. I want to play you another clip from the documentary.
At this point, I feel like I'm allowing them to explore their creative side and act in an atmosphere where I get to control it versus Hollywood.
Do they see it like that?
Oh, yeah. They know 100%. They're actors. That's what they tell everyone.
Fortessa, what did you think when you first heard that?
I think it's really difficult for 7-year-olds generally to tell what is real and what is not real. Like, they're literally asking questions like when they see cartoons or something like, wait, is that real or not? And so I think it's really difficult to say that they see the perfect delineation, especially in this mom's case where the kids aren't playing specific roles. Like they don't have like pseudonyms or anything. Like they're going online and they're going online as themselves.
Right.
So I'm not sure if they can understand the difference.
You talked about this moment we're in where the dark side of parent influencing is finally being exposed. On the most extreme end of things, we saw the YouTube mommy vlogger Ruby Frank. She was sentenced to prison for child abuse earlier this year. How are the Sharenters confronting this new wave of criticism, would you say? Do you feel like they're really like engaging with it, or are they kind of like, oh, this will pass?
I don't think they're fully engaging with it.
Okay.
I think I talked to a lot of people who wouldn't go on record for the story, and they said, we don't want to bring more attention to this. We don't want to like give more kind of air to the controversy. And so I think that they're hoping that it will pass and that they can continue making their living how they're making it. But then you also see the people who are fully engaging with it and making different decisions based on it. So it depends person by person.
What kinds of different decisions are these parents making when it comes to, you know, hearing about all these criticisms? Are they making different decisions at all, would you say?
Yeah, so there is this movement where people are either not showing their kids, but still talking about parenthood and motherhood, which I find to be really striking because it's content totally based around parenthood, but without showing the kids. Or they'll show the kids like from the back, or they'll show them like with emojis over their faces, like kind of trying to like protect their privacy while also talking about their identity as mothers and parents. So that's really fascinating because even like 2 years ago, that would have been so bizarre if an influencer was like posting their kid with an emoji over their face. And now it's just kind of like, oh, yeah, that makes sense.
What's the most shocking thing that you've sort of come across in, because again, you spent, I feel like I'm talking to somebody who spent, 2 years in this world, but I spent a lot of time and energy trying to ignore this world very specifically. And so, first of all, grateful for you for diving into it. But second of all, what's been like the most shocking thing that you've kind of come across as you've reported deeper and deeper into the story?
I think the stress that the kids feel knowing that so much of their family's financial health is reliant on the content that they're making is very difficult. And it's striking because I think many kids are privileged enough to not think about how their parents make money, but these kids are have like a front row seat and they know that they're the main stars. And so that stress is really, it's grating on them.
Let me ask you about artificial intelligence for a moment, because there's been so many conversations about AI. We're seeing these horror stories about how the images of children end up being used to recreate different images. Are the Sharenters that you talk to, are they thinking at all about how AI might change their content?
They are. The ones who have taken their kids offline mentioned that to me. They said, we don't know where AI is going to go, and I don't want to feed all these images into the internet ether and not know how they're going to come back to me. And it's interesting. I had this one parent influencer who took her kids offline, but then these fan pages sprung up with tens of thousands of followers, and it was all stuff that she had deleted,
Oh my
but it's
God.
still out there, right? Like it doesn't. I don't know. It makes me think of when I was a kid and my mom would be like, the internet is forever. Like you can't really delete anything. And they are worried about that.
When you think about the story and how long you've been spending sort of reporting on it, I think one thing that it's really changed is how much those children are able to talk now, I think one of the byproducts of that is that you see reporting like yours. Reporters were able to spend some time with these children or these former children who used to sort of do this work, and they now have a voice for themselves. In the 2 years that you've been reporting on this, how would you say the story has evolved or changed?
I think it's become a cultural touchstone. Like people outside of just the influencer world are talking about it. And I don't have to explain this story to like relatives that are like older. I don't have to be like, okay, so there's mom influencers, right? Like they're like, oh no, we've heard about that. And it's like there really is this cultural moment where we're all kind of like grappling with like where the parent influencers have been and where they're going. And so I think just the fact that there are laws being introduced, that there was one law passed, that people are interested in the work that I'm doing. Because I think in the beginning, there was kind of this like, so what? And now there's this deep interest.
That is my conversation with Fortessa Latifi. She's a journalist based in Los Angeles. You should definitely go find her latest work in Cosmopolitan. And also, there is a 20-minute documentary on YouTube called The Sharenting Reckoning.
Hi, I'm Jessie Cruikshank.
Jessie Cruikshank.
I host the number one comedy podcast called Phone a Friend.
Girl, let's phone a friend.
Not only do I break down the biggest stories in pop culture with guests like Dan Levy and members of NSYNC, I do it with my own personal boy band singing jingles throughout. Because it's my show.
It's your show, girl.
New episodes of Phone a Friend.
Yeah.
Drop Thursdays wherever you get your podcasts.
So work it, girl. Yeah, work it.
Okay, that's enough.
I'm Alamine Abdul-Mahmoud, and this is Commotion. This week, the art world is mourning the death of Richard Serra. Richard was an American sculptor who was widely acknowledged as one of the greatest of his era. He died on Tuesday at the age of 85. We should say that Richard is best known for these gigantic steel sculptures that feel like they could swallow you whole. The one that I'm most familiar with is the one that you might also know, too. It's an installation called Tilted Spheres. And maybe you don't know it has a name, or you don't know what you're even walking through, or that it's a work by Richard Serra to begin with. But if you've ever passed through Terminal 1 at Toronto's Pearson International Airport, you've definitely seen it. It looks like a giant, basically this enclosure where this massive space subtly kind of narrows. But there's another Richard Serra piece that is a little bit north of Toronto, near King City, a huge installation that a lot of people don't necessarily know about because it's technically not open to the public, but has local heritage status. It's called Shift, and it is a massive concrete sculpture that Richard built in the early 70s. Writer Sean McAuliffe has called it the closest thing Southern Ontario has to a Stonehenge. But this is not a typical tourist attraction, let's say, because to see Shift, you got to walk through some farmland near King City, Ontario. My CBC Radio 1 pal, Lise Hossein, is among the folks who have made that trek. She's here to talk about that experience and also Richard Serra and why he's so important. Lise, good morning, friend.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I'm happy that you're here because this is your world and I'm here. I'm really excited to hear about it. So let's start with maybe talking about Richard Serra. He's someone whose work has been shown at the biggest, most important galleries in the world. We're talking about the MoMA. We're talking about the Guggenheim in Spain. So how did one of the most celebrated American sculptors of his time end up laying down these slabs of concrete in a farmer's field north of Toronto? How did this happen?
Yeah. In 1970, Serra asked to visit the land of this art collector named Roger Davidson that was in King City. I believe at the time it was a potato field. And so he went there with an artist named Joan Jonas, and they walked this clearing. And as they walked, the topography of the land is such that there are points where you kind of can't see each other that well, and then you reappear. So they walked to the farthest point in the field at which they could still see each other. Mm-hmm. And Richard Serra built his installation Shift around that experience, around that walk.
Being able to like see each other the whole time.
Yeah.
Describe the landscape around Shift. So how do you get to Shift? What's around it there?
I mean, if you're going there, allegedly, as I did, the landscape, there's a subdivision that borders Shift.
Yeah.
But between the subdivision and Shift, there's kind of marshy land. There's farmers' fields. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of bees, burrs. But it opens out into this clearing where if you know what you're looking for, you'll see Shift. Mm-hmm. If you don't know what you're looking for, you might just think you're in a field.
I'm fascinated by the idea of a lot of people just passing by it and not necessarily knowing the thing that they're actually staring at. You know, like the idea of like, it's there for you to look at because you know that it's there. But if you don't know if you don't know that it's a piece of artwork at all, what would be your relationship to it? Like, what would you see when you arrive on the site?
Well, I like that Sean called it our Stonehenge because I think it would seem like a very mysterious set of two concrete walls emerging out of the ground.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's something that I think Richard Serra certainly meant for us to see it. Now you're not supposed to see it. It's on private property.
Right.
But I think it feels like a real part of the landscape. So if you know what you're looking for, it's quite meaningful. And if you don't, maybe quite mysterious.
So you get to this installation, allegedly, through whatever paths you took to get there. When you see it, how did it make you feel? How do you experience that installation?
I think part of the process of getting there, because if you do decide, don't go there. But if you do go there, it takes a little work to get there. And then you emerge into this clearing. There are trees with like whooping cranes nesting and or blue cranes, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
So there's a real peace in the space. There's something that feels quite magical about it. And as you walk along these walls, you're really taking that same path that Serra and Joan Jonas took.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a sense of history. And also you feel the time that's passed. The concrete walls that rise out of the ground are, you know, they've taken some wear and tear over the years. So you really feel that sense of the time that's gone by. It's a kind of a magical experience.
It sounds like a pilgrimage. What compelled you to make the pilgrimage?
So I'm an art historian by education. Mm-hmm. So Mr. Richard Serra has kind of loomed large in my life. And I'd always heard that this installation existed.
Mm.
But I didn't know where it was. And it seemed kind of daunting to get there. So when I finally found it on Google Maps, it is there. It's a little dot.
Yeah.
It seemed worth it to try to find the way.
I was reading that Richard Serra himself compared museums to funeral homes. There's something about his work that is like basically begging to be structured out in the world somewhere, like Shift, you know, like his installation at Pearson Airport, which is basically like squeezed in the middle of a bunch of stores, right, and the terminal. But one of his most controversial works is one called Tilted Arc, which was removed from a plaza in New York because there was so much outcry. Do you want to talk a little bit about the idea of Richard Serra making site-specific, you know, art and what that means?
So, you know, Richard Serra was always interested in the relationship of the work he was making to the place in which it was.
Yeah.
And so you can see his work in museums, certainly, but sometimes seeing it kind of out in the wild creates a different experience. But I think the really special thing about Richard Serra when it comes to public or site-specific art is that it's easy, especially with abstract art, to not feel a relationship with it, feel kind of like excluded from it.
Because it's largely conceptual, right? Like, mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I think with his work, just because of the scale of it and the material and the fact that you can walk around it or into it, it has this unique ability to create a really physical relationship with a viewer. It creates feelings, sometimes feelings of claustrophobia or feelings of being dwarfed. So I think that he had this unique ability to connect with people who maybe usually wouldn't have had that a relationship with abstract sculpture. Yeah.
I mean, the Tilted Arc controversy is maybe the most fun to get into because, you know, it's like this giant steel slab situation that ends up, you know, splitting a plaza in half. And then there is such an outcry that there are public hearings to be like, all right, we get it. You made your point. This art needs to be removed, right? Like that's sort of how that unfolded.
Yeah, it's a really interesting story, and I think one of the great examples of like the people really coming out against a piece of like high art.
Yeah.
So Tilted Arc was in this plaza in New York. It actually went to a hearing, and people complained that it was hard to walk around, so they could no longer go straight through the plaza to get to the other side. You had to walk around this huge wall.
Yeah, which was maybe the point of the actual art piece.
Yeah, to be this thing bisecting this plaza.
Yeah.
During the hearings, there were many art heavyweights who were part of the hearings. There was a security guard who actually said that it was dangerous because it could make a bomb blast concentrated, which if you think about, you know, Timothy McVeigh and what happened afterward, was it a valid point? I don't know. But it's interesting that it became part of the conversation. So it was a really contentious moment, I think, in post-minimalist art and in public art.
I think, like, to me, the idea of contentious, the idea of art as making you have some kind of reaction, that's what you want as an artist. You want some people to go, I have strong feelings and thoughts about the idea that you're putting forth in the world. When you think about Richard Serra's legacy, what do you think will be his impact?
I think Tilted Arc is key to his legacy because it really was this moment when art became such a huge conversation in everyday life. But I also think that his legacy is in how his art is able to connect with people. So if you think of Tilted Arc as one pole of his art where people were really coming out against it, and then you look at Tilted Spheres in Pearson where people want to be in
people
that
want
space.
To actually actively walk through it.
Yeah, it seemed like once he changed from these really angular forms to like things that were more curved, it was like Richard Serra giving you a hug.
Containers,
The softer side of Richard Serra. So there's really a narrative, an emotional narrative arc through his work that I think is really important.
Lise, I appreciate you being here. Thank you. And I'm really happy to hear this alleged pilgrimage that maybe never happened.
Yes, alleged.
Alleged.
Thanks, Salamine.
Thank you for your time. Really appreciate it. Lise Hossain is a senior producer here on CBC Radio 1 in Toronto. We were speaking about the late, great sculptor Richard Serra, who died on Tuesday. He was 85. Summers and I'm not in my bed on the back of the bus in a bunk with the band. Going so hard, gotta choose myself. Underpaid and overwhelmed. I might cook clean, but still won't fall. Still working on my life, you know. Only God knows, only God knows, only God knows. 16 carriages driving away while I watch them ride with my fears away into the summer sunset on a holy night on a long back. Come on. 16 carriages from Beyonce. We are mere hours. We are 16 hours away from the arrival of Beyonce's album, That arrives tonight at midnight. I cannot wait. We are hearing that there's a Miley Cyrus collaboration, that we are hearing there's a Willie Nelson collaboration. Beyonce giving us a country album. This is a moment I've been waiting for a long time. We'll be talking about it on the show on Tuesday, so we'll see you then. In the meantime, that is it for the podcast today. Remember, you can listen to this show anytime you like, wherever you get your podcasts. We're on Instagram at CommotionCBC. I'm Alameen Abdul Mahmoud. See you next week.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.